True. Wow.
Chorus number 4. I looked at the red winter, disgusting dusk of the world, saw the alleys beyond Brooklyn.
Well, I understand it is a high crime and misdemeanor to interrupt Jack Kerouac, or excuse me, Allen Ginsberg, but I'm going to do it anyway because on the phone we have an interview regarding a couple of days ago I mentioned there was a massive fish kill in the Upper Delta. And Greg Karras is on the phone. He's one of the... tell us your title, Greg. You're with Communities for a Better Environment?
Yeah, I'm a senior scientist here.
Oh, great, great. Now, on May 1st, in the Contra Costa Times, there was a massive front-page article. The headline, from memory, I think it was Environmental Sirens in Bay Are Screaming. And it goes into some detail about copepods being the basic food for most of the different types of fish in the bay, and that copepods have gone through a massive die-off. And that said, there's a massive starvation going on in the Upper Delta, above the saltwater. It's the freshwater in the Upper Delta. And they went into some detail about, I believe there were certain types of smelt that had gone from 62,000 in a survey to 190. There were types of bass that had gone from 19,000 in a survey to about 55 or so. So this is a massive die-out. And what can you tell us about this, Greg?
Well, it's been coming a long time, and it's part of a syndrome that has the small business salmon fishermen close to going out of business right now after the last year before fish kills up in the Klamath River. The whole ecosystem here, the San Francisco Bay estuary ecosystem, which ranges from the Sierras to the Gulf of the Farallones out in the ocean, biologically speaking, it was the major food production resource for humans before Europeans came and after Europeans came until about the Industrial Revolution around 1900. Then fisheries started closing, fisheries started collapsing. Now the bay is contaminated. Hundreds and hundreds of people still eat off the bay. They fish the bay for food. They're low-income people of color. And they're becoming contaminated. The water's being diverted. The wetlands are being developed, and this major food resource that we relied on even as humans in the past, and probably will have to again, is near collapse. And a lot of people who've been watching the bay have been saying that for many years.
Well, and yeah, obviously we're poisoning our own bed. But in this case, are there any indicators to say what specifically is causing this massive die-out?
Well, you know, you can't say it's all because of the massive pollution from the oil refineries, because if you're poisoned and you also don't have enough fresh water to get your food resources there, that's a problem. You can't say it's all because of diverting more than half of the natural river flow, mostly to agribusiness in the Central Valley, because of the pollution. And you can't say it's just those two things because more than 90% of the historic wetlands have been diked and filled. Then there's invasive species and a few other stresses. But those are the big ones: pollution, water diversion, and diking and filling of wetlands.
Right, right. And as we were talking the other day to there was an EPA scientist, Bruce Herbold, he mentioned as well that there's been a spraying of herbicides on the natural grasses that are growing along the shore, and that apparently is having some effect as well. What do copepods need to eat? What do they need to survive? What could we do in this instance to reinvigorate the copepods?
Well, copepods are part of the food chain or food webs, And I think the key point is we need every link in this chain, not just one. And I think we need to get past trying to manage this as a crisis, one species at a time. Copepods, there's many different species. Many of them are very sensitive, very vulnerable to toxicity. And the copepod die-off that's starving the fish could very well end up being proven to be, in this case, specifically because of a specific agricultural spraying. I don't know for sure yet. But it's, again, what the ecosystem needs is to be clean, to have adequate water flow, and to have adequate wetlands. And it's being stressed in all of those ways. So I just don't think it would be accurate to say that we're going to protect the bay by doing only one thing. We need to do all of those things.
Right. And Bruce Herbold had also mentioned, as you just did, the pesticides. Apparently there was a transition from pyrethrins as opposed to the petrochemical types of pesticides.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think we should call it what it is. They're biocides. They're chemicals that are designed to kill, and only the most arrogant chemical industry scientists would pretend that they know all of the ways that they might kill. So when we take it, you know, one, again, take too small a focus, one chemical at a time, and miss the big picture, you can go from DDT to dieldrin to chlordane to the next pesticide to the organophosphates and then to the pyrethrins, and they all have different side effects, but they're all chemicals that are designed to kill, and they all kill things besides what they were applied to kill. In this case, it may end up being the copepods and the fish that eat them.
Right, right. And now, in addition, we know that the MTBE, the gasoline additive, has been essentially unstopped, and then as well, it's just a week or so ago in, I believe it was the U.S. Supreme Court, they determined that, it wasn't the Supreme Court, it was in the new energy bill that went through Congress, that Californians will not be able to sue the refineries for polluting us with MTBE. They've essentially given them a waiver for the pollution of MTBE. Is there any chance that this MTBE is also a factor in the copepods, or is this something that is just an additional pile-on?
It's impossible to say for sure that it has no effect. MTBE is a huge concern in groundwater and drinking water, and I'd be worried about it with respect to human health there. It's pretty volatile, as anyone who remembers what it smelled like when they were, before we got it out of gasoline here, and you'd smell it when you were filling up your tank at the gas station. So it doesn't stay in surface water long, tends to go into the air and into our lungs. I'd be more worried about the combinations of pollutants that do tend to stay in the water and build up. There's still, based on the U.S. EPA's assessment of chemicals that are polluting the bay to the level of causing harm or potential harm, you've got mercury, you've got dioxins, you've got PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are petrochemicals. Combustion sources. It's raining down in toxic fallout, getting into the runoff, getting into the sediment, and concentrating the food chain. You've got a bunch of the old banned pesticides that are still hanging around, the DDT metabolites. Tremendous problem with PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, which are used in electrical industry. until the 1970s when they were banned, and they're still a huge problem in the Bay. A lot of other toxic metals. You know, and the list goes on. There are literally tens of thousands of potentially toxic chemicals in commerce, and all of the ones that are persistent, that don't degrade quickly in the environment, either end up going up in the air or they end up washing into our surface waters, and our bay is a bellwether for our chemical health.
Right, right. Let's see, in addition, good grief, what was the other? Oh, yeah, there's the port of Stockton, as I understand it, is actually it is an actual larger port than the port of Oakland. And so I would wonder whether or not there are spills up there that are being reported. Is there activity coming up and down the ship activity that's up and down the what passes for a river up there towards Stockton that could be also a factor in this?
Yeah, just the pollution that has been reported and measured. There are toxic hotspots in the river up around Stockton, and there's also dredging that's done for the ship channel that alters the flow of water, changes the salt matrix, and, you know, probably the easiest way for a listener to get a sense of how changing the salt balance in a water body might affect the fish is think about how long you'd survive drinking salt water. Different critters are tuned biologically to different amounts of salt in the water. Freshwater fish don't live in salt water. Saltwater fish don't live in freshwater, except for salmon and a few species that have to actually make a biological transition when they migrate. Most of the life that lives in a river, lake, or stream, or estuary doesn't survive well if the salt changes. So the dredging, changing the currents, just exacerbates the water diversions that dry up the freshwater flows and further increases the stress on the ecosystem.
Well, so then that said, the cheap products that we're hauling over here from China, essentially what we're paying at the cash register does not reflect what losses we're taking to the food supply and the stability of our ecosystem here in America, or for that matter, any other part of the world. You may get cheap products from slave wages, but when all of those products are brought in here, they essentially are creating an environmental damage in the hauling process. I take it that what you're saying with the addition of salt water, you mentioned the diverting of channels creates problems with salt infusion into the freshwater, but I would also take it that some of these ships are using saltwater ballast, and then they discharge their saltwater ballast up into the freshwater up in Stockton, and then that saltwater is coming down and changing the pH of the freshwater of the river.
Obviously, if you dump a ballast of salt water in freshwater from a big ship, it will change the salt locally. That's probably small compared to the amount of salt change from just having a deeper channel for that ship to go through. But you're raising a key point for the Bay when you talk about the dumping of ballast water from ships coming from other places, because there's something else that sometimes in that water is animals and plants from other areas. There's a good story about that for the Bay. It's called the Asian clam, Putum corbula. It was brought over probably from Chinese estuaries in the 1980s. In ship ballast, it's believed that's probably how it got here. Not native to the Bay. And You know, we may never know all of the reasons why it took hold, but undoubtedly the weakening of the ecosystem, the pollution that was measurably impacting some of the shellfish that it replaced, probably weakened existing ecosystem. Anyway, Potomac corbulate took off. It crowded out the clams and shellfish that were here before. It was a world-class event of a species invasion, and it had all sorts of side effects. This new clam is a much more efficient filter feeder. It may be eating a lot more of those copepods a lot more quickly, and that is a stress on the ecosystem that takes food sources away from the fish that would otherwise eat those plankton. And it also bioaccumulated, concentrated some of the toxic chemicals dumped by the oil refineries, like selenium, much more efficiently, so that the critters that were eating this clam, instead of eating the shellfish that were there before it, were getting a much bigger dose of the toxics from the oil refineries, as a result of the combination, again, the combination of the pollution right here in the bay from the oil refineries on the shore and the invasive species, like this clam, the toxic impact on animals and people who eat fish further up the food chain was magnified dramatically. So this is, you know, again, this is an ecosystem that has is being damaged in many ways, and it's synergistic. It's like drinking alcohol and taking Valium at the same time. It's a lot worse if you have both. And what we've got is water diversion, dredging, toxic pollution, invasive species, and diking and filling of wetlands. Now, people should remember that if you want to restore the bay, you have to think about how more than 90% of the historic wetlands are gone. They've been diked and filled, and we need to start getting some of those back if we want to have a bay that produces food resources for future generations.
Well, that said, you're working with communities for a better environment. I would take it that you've got chapters not just all around the bay, but all around California. And I'm wondering, you know, obviously we're in a stressed position with the economy, and there are a number of people who are unemployed or really don't want to work for these major corporations and would like to be doing something. You know, if you were to look at this period of time, and there were a number of listeners that wanted to get involved and take part in some portion or another, is there any way that you can imagine that their efforts can be directed to causing some real change here? I mean, obviously, we can direct them your way. Communities for Better Environment has a website, cbecal.org. Communities for Better Environment California.org is what it stands for, cbecal.org.
Yeah, and if you're in Northern California in the Bay Area, our Oakland office, 510-302-0430. If you're in Southern California, our Huntington Park office, 323-861-9771.
Okay, 9771. Okay. All right. Well, I was going to say, if in your dream world, what would you say would be a good starting point for whether it's the California legislature, the various cities and counties here in the Bay Area or around California? What should we be doing to start remediation? You know, obviously, if there's a fish die-off that's essentially taken 99%, and we're down to something less than 1%, something needs to be done right away. And in your flights of fancy of positive thought, what would you say would be a real, real good starting point?
Yeah, well, I guess I have to say that I look at it in a very practical way, and I think that CBE does as well. You know, first of all, people are part of the ecosystem. like it or not. That's a fact. And people affect policy. In my case, I enjoy working for environmental justice, for the people who are... Now, remember, the human side of this, as I said before, low-income people, mainly people of color who are fishing our waters for food, to put food on the table and feed their kids, they're getting the biggest dose of these toxics. They're the most motivated to make change. And in the, out of the same communities that are in the shadow of the smokestacks of the oil refineries and the power plants and the freeways, they're breathing the pollution before it rains down into the bay. These are my bosses. These are people and communities that are increasingly mobilizing to make change. Right now, we're close to getting the first refinery flaring control rule in the country on the books in the Bay Area, and the second in the country on the books in the Los Angeles area. And that's also going to stop some of the toxic fallout to the waters, as well as protecting our lungs. So it's, you know, one person at a time, one step at a time. But what we need to do is build, we think, from the grassroots up, and build community power for communities to clean up at their own communities and keep clean, safe jobs, keep the polluting corporations from exploiting us. And that builds up, we believe, from the grassroots, community by community, to the county levels, to state government, and eventually, hopefully, someday soon, to the federal level, we may again have a policy that protects public health, protects people and the environment from the pollution.
Well, you had mentioned flaring. What is flaring exactly?
Well, you ever gone by a refinery and seen a huge fire coming out of the tall stack or smoke?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's flaring. In short, flares are supposed to be a safety valve for when there's an upset, but they're being used routinely for disposal, disposing the petrochemical gases instead of recovering them. Light gases are recovered in the vapor recovery systems in the gas stations that people are familiar with. Well, a bigger version of that is already being used to some extent by some refineries to recover the gases instead of just burning them off and creating open burning petrochemical pollution. Flares are putting many tons of pollutants into local communities' air when they go off, sometimes hundreds of tons in a couple of hours in a really bad case. They're massive sources of episodic pollution. People live nearby on the fence line, consistently report asthma attacks and other symptoms when they happen. And the refineries have been using them for disposal this way for decades, despite community complaints. So we've built a campaign over the last couple of years in the Bay Area and in Southern California with the communities on the fence line to demand, and we think we'll win, action to recycle these gases instead of burning them off and polluting us.
Right. You know, over 100 years ago, Charles Dickens, dealing with massive pollution in England, wrote that the owners of factories should live within a block or so of their factory, and that way the management of hazardous wastes would be handled by the owners, because they would be in such proximity. Obviously now, with the development of corporations, where people on the other side of the world or in the flash of a sleight of hand of the stock market can own and then not own shares of various corporations, that principle of ownership and having responsibility for the toxic wastes and the hazardous conditions of a factory are completely negated. But that would be a starting point to me, is the owners must live in proximity to what they own. But that said, Communities for Better Environment, having the ability to mandate some forms of cleanup, I would take it that you'd been trying for a decade or so to get just this basic pseudo-scientific method that they're using. I would take it that these flares are actually a way of keeping gasoline prices high. They're essentially wasting massive amounts. If, for example, they had a new shipment and they hadn't burned through it all, they'd do a quick flare and burn up whatever's topping off their tanks, and then that allows them to accept a new shipment. And so with supply and demand, they would normally have a clearance sale and get all that gasoline out there at the pumps, but they would do these flares instead to keep prices artificially high?
You're close. I think it's actually a little worse than that. First of all, oil refining is by its very nature a polluting and very hazardous business, right? flares are used and should be used, you know, if they're going to keep refining, they should use the flare when they have an upset and they need to relieve the pressure so something doesn't blow up. They burn off the gases so the gases aren't released straight. But the problem is that the refiners are using that safety excuse as an excuse for basically dumping. Think about, you talked about Charles Dickens more than 100 years ago. Well, you know, oil refineries were around from about the 1870s.
Yeah, about
80s.
Right. Yeah.
They were around before the light bulb, before Benz and Ford made internal combustion engine cars. And in those days, they were selling gas oil to the cities to light gas lamps. People might remember gas lights in old movies. Well, that was the product. Gasoline in those days was a low value or relatively useless byproduct of the oil refining process. So guess what they did? The refineries used to run the gasoline out into the rivers at night, just dump it, just dispose of it. So fast forward to now, where gasoline is an extremely valuable product. You don't see refineries intentionally dumping their gasoline into the rivers because they want to sell it. But one of the big volume byproducts of refining that they can't sell for a lot of money, especially out on the West Coast, is the gases, the gaseous portion of the petroleum that comes out of the refining process. So, in truth, when they're not using the flares for controlling refinery upsets to prevent explosions and fires for what they're supposed to be used for, what they're doing is they're running those gases out into the air through the flares. They're using them for inappropriate, we think probably illegal, disposal.
Right, and
we put one of the oil companies on notice that we intend to sue them if they don't stop doing this. We have been able to use the law. You mentioned MTBE earlier. CBE sued 13 oil companies in California for MTBE to get them to pay for the cleanup so the public wouldn't have to. And we had a favorable settlement of that case. And thankfully, it happened before, long before Congress changed the law, as you said they're now trying to do.
Yeah, negate our ability to sue. That's such an amazing thing that
I think CBE's success in using the law to at least get the industry to pay for some of the cost of cleaning up the MTBE from, you know, these 13 companies. I think that shows that it means something in areas where the companies haven't been held legally liable for paying for the cleanup of our drinking water supplies and groundwater supplies that they've polluted. What Congress is proposing to do could have a really bad negative impact. And that's not speculative. to the extent that my organization's work with the successful litigation shows that we can use the existing laws to get the companies to clean up and, like you said, at least internalize some of their costs of doing business that are polluting us.
Right. And, you know, right now here in San Francisco, we're going through a budget crisis phase, and every other county and community in San Francisco, or in California and the rest of the nation are going through the same. And mass transit is being put on the chopping block. And obviously, if we know that Bush and his oil cronies are attacking California with high gasoline prices, and we own a mass transit system, it's in our best interests to facilitate that mass transit system, because not only do we as individuals not have to pay good money, our discretionary income, into these same energy pirates, but what we do pay into our bus company, our mass transit, our BART, our rapid transit, and our streetcars, electric trolleys, all sorts of different things, that is an actual investment that we get to hold at the end. And the less money that goes to these oil refineries, the less pollution comes out of them, and the more we get to control them by strengthening our mass transit system. So that sounds like it might be an option. The more we support our mass transit, the more we're going to support our own self-preservation. Another aspect which would make sense would be furthering light rail or other types of rail, at least along the shoreline up there along the upper delta. We do have the Amtrak, as well as there's a series of shuttles. They're predominantly rush hour, but Caltrans do run trains up that way. And the more we can develop the enlightenment in California of using the train system, the more we're going to be able to yank that, you know, the millions and millions of dollars per week out of the hands of the refineries and get them back under our control.
Yeah, well, it's I don't think it's easy to exaggerate the danger of our dependence on petroleum. It appears to be running down. It has in the U.S. California peaked already. If we wait too long to make the change, it's going to destroy our economy to the extent that it'll be difficult to make the switch later, in addition to all the damage and the climate change. So the obvious first step, you're right, public transit. And, you know, to be fair, the United States federal government has overall subsidized petroleum-based transportation, highway building, cars, more than it has subsidized mass transit for decades. It was a problem way before the 2000 election. It's gotten worse, yes. People in the Bay Area may be interested to know that there's a part of that problem that's really, if not racist, at least discriminatory, that we can do something about locally. CBE got together with the Transit Workers Union in the East Bay, and we have just filed suit against the Metropolitan Transportation Commission for discriminatory action. What they're doing here in the Bay Area, and I think probably in other cities, is they're disproportionately cutting funding to the inner city transit, AC transit, for example, where riders are seeing the fares go up, the bus lines being eliminated or service cut back. And it turns out that there's about three times more subsidy given to BART and Caltrain per passenger mile than to these inner-city services. In other words, separate but unequal treatment for low-income communities of color. And interestingly enough, the agency's own analysis for many years has said that they're never going to be able to get their transit ridership up even to 15% of transportation in the Bay Area until they start focusing on fixing the inner city transit, because that's where the most gains in getting out of our cars, in reducing oil usage, and reducing pollution by mass transit can be made. Well, that's where the cuts are happening. And is it racist? Is it just because these are low-income people who have less political clout? Well, it's certainly discriminatory in our opinion, and we're getting together with the union to try to do something about it. So, you know, there's another area where people can get directly involved to make a real difference. Get out of your car if you can. If you can't, join us and stand up to the people who are cutting your transit service who haven't put a bus line near you yet.
It sounds almost like sabotage in the way that the mass transit's being pulled apart. Old money, the establishment in this country, the old money boys, have made bad investments for a century. They've invested in nuclear. They've not invested in solar. They've not invested in wind power. They've not invested in all sorts of alternative energy sources, much less, you know, the pesticides that are killing us. These are all petrochemical predominantly. And so they don't know how to back out of their bad investments, and rather than do the right thing and invest in something smart, they will buy politicians and force them to continue to reinvest in the bad investments. So, yeah, what you're describing is something that's been going on for a good century, and how we get the old money to... Frankly, I'm at the point where I don't expect these people to ever invest wisely, and we're just going to have to figure out some sort of a jubilee so that we can do the proper reinvestment in what matters. Frankly, I was talking to the governor of Montana not too long ago, and as you may know, wind power in North Dakota, hypothetically, if you could capture all of the wind in North Dakota, it would deal with all of the electrical needs for all of the United States, North Dakota alone. And so eastern Montana also gets the potential of capturing a massive amount of good electrical energy in there. And the governor of Montana is very eager to get started on wind power. It's going to create an enormous income for the state, as well as take a lot of the power burdens off of the rest of the nation, the coal creating the asthma and the burning of natural gas toward electrical ends. And so the idea of reinvesting, a conservative state like Montana is very eager to get started on something like this. And so we shouldn't necessarily think of the rest of the nation as being a bunch of dumbasses and fuddy-duddies. They are just as trapped by bad investment. Before we go, though, are there other things that Communities for Better Environment encourage people to do? And again, give your phone numbers both here and in the southern part of the state.
All right. I think that the most important thing that people can do is get out and make a change if you want to see a change. Get organized, join an organization. Of course, I want you to join CBE. And again, the phone number up here in Oakland, 510-302-0430. Join us if you want to. If you're more interested in joining another organization, please do that. The thing is, we've got the people. There's a small number of people who control the money and capital, and I think you're being kind when you say they're making bad investments. The energy industry, their plan is to go back to nuclear plants after the oil runs out. Because they can't centralize control over solar energy as easily, I think. But But in San Francisco, where the low-income community of color in the southeast, Bayview Hunters Point, Potrero neighborhoods, got organized and demanded change, they convinced first the city, and then they even convinced the state that they should make a transition now to closing power plants. They're very close to closing the existing fossil fuel power plants in San Francisco. The first one may be closed this year, come September. And what are they putting in place? A whole portfolio of clean energy, solar, efficiency, wind power possibly, although it may be outside San Francisco. And they've proved that it's cost-effective. This stuff's on the shelf. Taking it off the shelf, putting in the kind of energy system, the kind of environment, the kind of justice that we want is really just a matter of taking responsibility for doing it ourselves. It's pretty clear, I think, that the people in power in Washington aren't going to do it for us. So again, CBE in Oakland, 510-302-0430. CBECal.org on the web. And in Southern California, 323-826-9771.
Well, great. We sure appreciate your interview, Greg. This is Greg Karras from, he's one of the staff scientists over at Communities for a Better Environment. And so if you'd like, we'll be glad to call on you in the future for other interviews. Sounds like there's plenty to work on and more need to start exposing the problems and getting down to some serious solutions.
Yeah, come about the 18th, 19th of July, there should be some big news on this refinery flare pollution issue. I appreciate that offer, David.
Oh, no trouble. By the way, you had mentioned that you were going after a particular refinery. Do you want to name names?
Well, there's no secret here. CBE has put Valero Corporation on notice that we intend to sue their Benicia refinery if they don't stop illegally, we allege, illegally using their flares for disposal.
Great, great. Now, Valero, is this privately owned and they subcontract for many other refineries, or are they specifically owned by one of the big sisters?
Valero is the company. Yeah. I think folks in the Bay Area at least can be forgiven of not being able to keep track of who owns these refineries. They've been changing hands a lot lately, and they've all changed names. Even the Chevron refinery, still owned by the same company, but not Chevron Texaco. The Valero refinery was built by Exxon, and it was owned and operated by Exxon until about 10 years ago. It's in Benicia, and it's the one you can see when you get to the north side of the Carquinez Strait Bridge on 680.
Okay, yeah, so that's constant flares. If people live in the area, is it a useful thing for them to keep a log of when they see these flares? Do you need people monitoring?
Absolutely. In fact, we've as part of the analysis for the flare control rule that the Bay Area Air District has proposed, we've asked the district to go back through its records of community complaints because every time somebody sees a flare at the refinery and then feels their eyes burning or smells the odor, that's an indication that somebody was exposed to it, and that's community-based evidence. So it is it's very useful.
So the actual time of day and the date, and if you have an idea of when it starts and stops, or at least the duration that you're able to personally observe it, that would be something that's absolutely needed. And again, give your phone number, area code 510-302-0430.
Correct.
All right, good. So, yeah, that sounds like something that people, at least if they're homebodies and living in the North Contra Costa area, or I suppose they can probably also see it from the other side of the bay as well.
Yeah. if you're near any of the refineries and you see it, and especially if you see it and you smell it or your eyes are burning, call CBE. 510-302-0430. But also call the Air District's complaint line. That's 1-800-334-ODOR. 1-800-334-ODOR.
All right, great. Thanks, Greg. And we'll be glad to give you a couple of calls in the future. Keep going with these interviews.
All right, David. Thank you.
All right, no trouble.
Bye-bye.
And again, that was Greg Karas with Communities for Better Environment. We'll try to develop another interview or two on this massive fish kill incident that's been described in the May 1st issue of the Contra Costa Times. Very ugly scene, and it's something that's got to get resolved. The massive die-out that's been reported has got to have a culmination toward our self-preservation. The self-preservation of the economy is being declared as more important than life itself, and we know where that madness goes.